Kia ora tātou, one and all, welcome. Good to see you here. I think most of you know me, Joe Hollander, Chair of the Funds North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and the Engineer Charitable Trust. And it is my pleasure, in conjunction with the City Library Heritage Team, to welcome you here tonight. I'm going to call on Wiramu Te Awiawi to give us a karakia, an introductory karakia, and then I'll have a couple of words before I introduce our speaker. So, Wiramu, please.
So I try. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. Kia ora.
Yeah, I'm in the right place. Don't worry. You know what's out of this bad. E tō mātou māti i tirangi, ki a tapu tōnua, ki a tā mātō rei tīratanga, ki a mete a tūre pai aikiru mō te whenua, ki a te anu ki tō tirangi, o mai ki a mātou i nā nei. E tarama mātou mō tēnei a muru mātahara. Me mātou hoki muru nei pia tōhinga ana ki mātou. Au hoki mātou e kāwea ki a mātou engai, au kāwea mātou i te kino a hoki, Tērangi tīratanga me te kaha me te kōrea, āke āke, āmene. Tēnā koe he tērangi tīra katoa, whāe, tēnā koutou, mamihi nui, kia koutou. Anei re mātou tō rūpuna kua au ki nei rāno i te korowai o tērangi Māori, ki te kawa nei, ki ringu te kapa pōtara. What I've just prayed, and you all know what I'm going to say, I've prayed, the best prayer in the world is called the Lord's Prayer, because that's all inclusive. Not only that, we went on to ask for God's Holy Spirit to be ministering and be over us tonight and look after us. It's quite interesting. My wife, her dad was in the 28th Marine Battalion, and he lost his leg over there. And he came back and he trieste his yard for 15. He named it Trieste, the boy after that, Sunny, Algiers, Tilva, Zoni. So I'm looking forward to the cordial tonight. And always, we're part of the baby boomers, the ones who are spoiled, but we didn't have the honour of seeing the war happen like our First World War and the Second World War. And the sad thing, it might be a point, is we learn nothing from history. And later, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Apologies for the mayor. He couldn't make it tonight. But seeing I'm under the tree of writing, I'm the mayor and you're to hold a ritual kia ora.
Kia ora. Thanks, I'd like to welcome back Colonel Dr. Peter Wood, who I think you all know now, is one of our expert speakers. He also happens to be the Deputy Chair of the Defence Advisory Group. And knows a lot about military history. So, Peter, without further ado, come and tell us about the New Zealand Division in Italy on the Gustav, or the Winter Line.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Please welcome Peter.
Kia ora tātou. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks everyone for coming along this evening to this presentation. I really like this period in the New Zealand Division's history. The early stages, Greece, Crete, are quite well known, and a lot too through North Africa. And when people think about the New Zealanders in Italy, sometimes their clock or their awareness starts with Cassino and then maybe finishes up towards Trieste and the like. Yet this little period, and it's really only 4 months, right at the end of 1943 and the first month of 1944, the division is different to what it was in North Africa. It, as I said in the title, it's been revitalised, it's been reinforced, some reinforcements have come over, it's been rested after North Africa, but it's actually been reorganised, and one-third of its combat power has been transformed from infantry to armour, and lessons learned from North Africa, but is it going to be effective? It's probably optimised for Northwest Europe rather than Italy. We've got less infantry. We've got more vehicles. So it's going to be interesting just to see how it goes. And with a whole lot of reinforcements from New Zealand, sure, Freiburg, Kippenberger, all those ones are there. There's many corporals or sergeants or lieutenants. Some were decorated in North Africa. If you're lucky enough, they know your platoon commander or your company commander. There's all those people there, but many of the private soldiers and many of the young junior NCOs are new. And so there's a bit of a risk here. So I think we just go through and have a look at how the New Zealanders perform in the new environment. So this is 1943. On the world scale, you know, we know now there's a bit of a tipping point and things are actually starting to look pretty good. The Allies have cleaned the Axis forces out of North Africa. And you're seeing the green up there, you've got the 1,000 bomber raids, all that sort of stuff starting to happen, you know, going deep into Germany. And even out of Russia now, and I bet the current Russian president would like his arrows to be going that way, but, you know, they are now launching out through Ukraine into it. So, you know, there's a bit of a tipping point, and I guess a feeling of optimism perhaps amongst the Allied leaders looking at the big picture. But the late New Zealand historian Rory Barber, whose dates and calendars for the Second World War we often often refer to, I think Joe too, he called this the hardest year of the war for New Zealand. And he wasn't talking necessarily about the division, he was talking about New Zealand and the round. So the government of the day had pretty much overcommitted our population of then slightly less than 2 million people. We pledged to keep the 2nd New Zealand Division in the Middle East and keep some a division or most of a division in the Pacific. We'd increase naval and air force recruiting so that we could up the number of sailors and the number of squadrons. But at the same time, Britain required, as did even the Americans lodged in New Zealand in 1943, food from our farms, and this required a whole lot of infrastructure inside New Zealand. By November 43, 70,000, mostly men but also women, were overseas, and there's another 66,000 or so serving in New Zealand. 43 out of every 100 workers in industry in New Zealand at the end of 1943 are women. So that's factories, farms, the whole thing there. So it's quite a thing. And just towards the end, of course, New Zealand had to deal with the fact that whilst it was great to have that first group of furloughed men come back to New Zealand, they had to go through the agony of a number of them for a variety of reasons, not wanting to go back. So there were a whole lot of issues going on in New Zealand. And I'm not judging any of them either. And a little picture there of the men. I love the fact that all those little holes in the side of the ship have all got eager faces waiting their turn to get out onto the harbour, onto the wharf in Wellington. But okay, at the start of the year, the war heading in a different direction. Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin would get together and have these conferences. And so at the start of the year, they had the Casablanca conference and they looked at the big strategy. So they basically decided that there would be no conditions. The German surrender had to be unconditional. They weren't going to give them any concessions. They were going to have to, therefore, invade Northwest Europe, but they would actually invade Sicily and Italy first. They agreed to intensify the bombing of Germany, and they also agreed the American plan to advance through the Central Pacific and the Philippines. So you only see Roosevelt and Churchill there. I think Stalin was otherwise interested in what was going on in Russia at the time and his forces going through Ukraine. But the British Chief of Staff at that meeting pushed for the invasion of Sicily and Italy in order to disperse German forces, to look at the possibility of Italy being knocked out of the war, but also from their perspective, the British perspective, a cleared Mediterranean meant you had a much shorter line of supply and line of communication, between the UK, out to India, Australia and New Zealand, sort of all these sort of regions. And Churchill characterised Italy as the soft underbelly of Europe. Of course, we've all followed Churchill's whims before in the First World War, and we ended up going to Gallipoli. In the Second World War, we'd already gone and been sidetracked towards Greece. So for a third time, we were going to follow a sort of a Churchill-type move and head off this time towards Italy. But would it be the soft underbelly? Well, it may have been other than this guy. Field Marshal, Luftwaffe Field Marshal, but army background in the First World War, but in the interwar period, he was instrumental in helping to establish the Luftwaffe and was given command of a number of Luftwaffe groups and rose, you know, made into Field Marshal of the Air Force. But he's kind of Hitler's go-to guy. He's everywhere. And whereas Erwin Rommel wanted to defend Italy in the north only, basically to give away the southern part, Kesselring understood the fact that given the Apennines running down the centre of Italy and the fact that there were major rivers running off it to the seas on both sides, he could, by deploying forces forward, he could impose a lot of delay through defensive lines. He also foresaw the fact that the Allies would probably, likely, attempt sea landings behind him, and so he cleverly arranged for forces to be kept deep in reserve so that when those eventualities arose, and we know they did a couple of times, he was not unbalanced by it all. So for the talk, I'm really just going to talk about that portion of the Italian theatre. So it's really where the New Zealanders are. We're talking about the northeastern side of the Apennines, where in the red, or probably the brown as it seems to look on your screen, is the Gustav line. But you'll note there are a whole lot of other lines that all link up, and they're all based around the high ground, usually on the northern side of the river. So they're using the river as an obstacle, and then the high ground, which has got natural roads and towns on it, to establish their defensive positions. And so essentially, you'll have the American 5th Army, General Mark Clark, advancing on the southern side, if you like, or the Tyrrhenian Sea side. And on the Adriatic side is the 8th Army under Montgomery, of which the New Zealand Division will rejoin. So the sort of the timeline, early May or mid-May, the division departed from Tunisia and did the big drive back to Mahdi camp near Egypt, and they got in that the revitalisation, the reinforcements, and they married up with their armoured brigade there. The Allies land in Salerno and Taranto, and then in a short time afterwards, the divisional cavalry goes and establishes an assembly area just outside of Taranto, which is going to become the entry point for the New Zealanders. And the little photograph down there shows New Zealanders being ferried ashore in barges. So through the period of the 5th to the 22nd of October, the divisional headquarters and the brigades are all starting to go on a couple of what they call flights, basically large groups of ships and things to get all their people, but all their heavy equipment and vehicles there. The Sandro River offensive kicks off, and we then join in that on the 27th and the 28th. We're going to then skip through to some of the battles around Orsona. Each battle I could spend the entire talk on, so I'll sort of just give you kind of the highlights, a bit of a flavour of it. And what you see is, over the period of basically the four battles that I discuss, the New Zealand division quickly has to evolve the way it's doing its fighting, not only because of the kind of vehicles it now has, but because of the way the Germans are doggedly holding the ground. And then the talk pretty much ends when the New Zealanders are in the winter lines. That's the end of December, basically Christmas Day through to January, and then they get the call to go across the other side to join the Americans and the US 5th Army for the for the casino operation. So the division that left New Zealand kind of looked like this. The 4th, 5th and 6th brigades made up each the 1st, 2nd and 3rd echelons, and they departed New Zealand a couple of months apart because we couldn't train them all and send them all in one way. So they went in 3 separate echelons, each of 3 infantry battalions, apart from the 5th brigade, where 28 Māori battalion was part of the 2nd echelon. They all ended up in the UK for a period, but eventually the division assembled in Egypt. 10 infantry battalions, a machine gun battalion, a divisional cavalry regiment, a number of artillery regiments and engineer companies. And you can see the little honey tanks that the divisional reconnaissance has got. Now, during the war in North Africa, during the fighting, the British had the tanks. And the problem was that the British tanks had different doctrine, i.e. ideas of how, when and where they should be employed, and they were under different arrangements for command and control. So who's telling those tanks to support me, when and where type thing. So as this thing went forward and Freyberg tried to improve relations with the British armoured forces, and he did, nevertheless there were these practical obstacles, and a decision was taken where the 4th Brigade would be converted into an armoured brigade. So 18, 19 and 20 battalions become armoured regiments armed with the Sherman tank, and also the 22nd battalion would leave the 5th Brigade and become a motorised infantry battalion, so basically on trucks, so it could move quickly either behind or with or sometimes even in front of the tanks to give them protection. And then the 28th Battalion just slipped straight in as the permanent member of the 5th Brigade, and so you end up with one armoured brigade and two infantry brigades. So you have an increase in firepower, protected mobility through the tanks, but you have an increased burden to get them across obstacles, namely rivers in the case of Italy, and you actually have less infantry to do the job. And that means less rest and ability to rotate the forces once they become engaged into protracted operations. Now, I know there's some members of or former members of combat support units in New Zealand, so I'm going to put these pictures up now because you don't get much of the talking to necessarily during the rest of it. But there's a divisional cavalry organisation. Normally that would move ahead of the division, but because of the nature of the country, that kind of patrolling was actually being done by infantry. And so now in Italy, more often than not, the cavalry would do route clearance, picketing the route, all that sort of stuff there. Engineers built many bridges. That's a big one. The opening picture showed a little one with the Shermans going over the top. Many, many bridges. They rebuilt roads. They filled in craters, constantly working on the roads to keep them open, to repair damage done by the Germans, including cratering and mining, but also the effects of the weather and the constant traffic movement backwards and forwards, and the effects of the weather. It was just non-stop work there. And lastly, the picture of the artillery, and I like this one because the caption of it that goes with that picture is that it's an artillery duel. We think of artillery just shoom, pow, attacking the opposition, but actually the old artillery used to fire at each other kind of and try to knock the other artillery out, and sometimes they'd even hold their fire so as not to disclose their position, and then once they all knew where the enemy artillery was, they'd home in on that. So there was a lot of cat and mouse amongst all the artillery and the observers and reporting positions and all that, and of course they required massive stockpiles of ammunition and therefore lots of truckloads of it, and they had to deal with the weather effects but also crest clearance. So great in the desert, there's not much to stop you, you're round between the gun and it landing, but with all the high ground, and you can see it in the back of the cavalry picture, often crest clearance was going to be a bit of an issue. So this is kind of like the Allied situation there, and you can see the Sand Road River mouth and the red line that's coming down towards sort of Naples there. You can see the area of Casino. So by the end of 1943, the Allies have not actually closed up on Casino yet, as we know now, and they're still south of the Sangro River. But what the big picture plan is to, with the Americans held up outside Casino, what if the 8th Army could push through the Sangro and then come back through, I'll just back that up, through Route 5, the red line going across towards Rome. That was what they thought they might be able to achieve by breaking through the Sangro River line, here, or the Gustav line based on the Sangro River. But the Germans, so just quick orientation before I cloud the map with shading. Down, you'll see in the bottom right corner the Sangro River running along there. The high ground is up to the northwest, or up to its sort of higher left. Castelfrantano, I won't talk much about that really, and Lanciano. For us, the big bits are going to be the Orsogna, as it was called, the town there, Poggio Fiorito, and Ariely. They're the main towns. So the Germans, though, they've got a plan for the defence. So the main line of defence, this is where you're fortifying the villages and you're using the lateral roads along the high ground to shift tanks and panzer grenadiers backwards and forwards and to observe down on the Allies trying to push up. They're commanded by old Smilo von Lückwitz, pictured there. And in the New Zealand zone, he's got panzer grenadiers, so armoured infantry, panzer regiments, so companies of panzer tanks, and he's even got a regiment of the dreaded parachutists, the old foe from Crete. So he's got a pretty good force, and that's what you have at the back. And out the front, as the tripwire, the 65th Infantry Division, and they were novices. They had not been in action before. They'd been basically guarding like anti-aircraft sites. They'd been prepared to go to Russia and then suddenly got diverted to come down to Italy. So they are forward of Castelfrantano, but forward to the river to act as a bit of a tripwire when the Allies come through. Now, the commander there, he himself is not very experienced. He's going to put his emphasis on those positions, i.e. let's hold our forts and our trenches, less emphasis on the soldier skills of patrolling, reconnaissance, and all that sort of stuff. And this is typical novices. We were like this a little bit in Greece, Crete, and North Africa in some instances. We saw the same with novice Italian and German units in North Africa, and now we see some of the German units exhibiting those exact same traits because they don't understand the risks at this point in time. They might be scared, but they don't understand the risks. And so as soon as the New Zealand division closed up on the river, they started patrolling. So this is small groups of infantry, lieutenants, corporals, small groups, maybe 5, 10, 15 men, and out they go across the river. So those arrows that you can see, the coloured ones, I think they're a little bit brown, that's sort of showing where the patrols originated, but the table on the left shows 43 patrols were undertaken in such a short period of time, and they'd be basically night patrols, deconflicted, so they didn't shoot each other up, but you can see from the little arrows, they got right over the river, and they were getting up into the ground that would by day be overlooking the river. This is going to then blood the new men and the new officers. So they haven't been in action. So you send them out on patrol and it starts to build up their confidence. They are starting to gather intelligence. So where are their crossing points? Can we cross the river here? Is the home or the far bank mined? Have they got observation posts? Is there a reaction force? And they can start to determine just what the Germans are doing. Had the Germans been patrolling, no doubt there would have been clashes and that would have prevented the Germans from operating on our side of the river line and maybe discovering the river crossing forces as they close up. But they were able to confirm that the Germans were not defending the river and that it was crossable on foot. And they assessed that a night operation would be a good one, because there were no that way it would negate the German observation that they would have by day, and that in fact it would mean what we would call an unopposed river crossing, because there was no one down on the river line. So the core plan essentially is to have multiple crossings by the New Zealand, Indian and 78th divisions in order to allow the opportunity to establish a bridgehead on the other side, and then drive around, as I said, towards Route 5 and get into Rome. So the objective for the New Zealanders was back up in this area around Wasona, and that's where we headed. In that general direction across the river there. So the New Zealand plan was essentially to cross the river with two brigades, infantry brigades forward, the only two that it had still, 5 and 6 brigade, and each of those committed between them two or three of the battalions. One, I think, was held in reserve, possibly 28th battalion for this operation. And they went across, they crossed in the night, the far bank was secured, each of the battalions crossed over, waded through the water, got themselves sorted out on the far bank, or the side nearest the Germans, and then they started to climb up towards their objectives. And kind of what it looks like is that. So now, each of the battalions is essentially broken itself into two columns. So whereas in the desert you attacked an extended line, well spaced out because of the artillery, in a complete change now, essentially you are advancing in single file, or maybe file, you know, two ranks, only enough spacing you know, to keep touch with the man in front in the dark, but you didn't have the wide formations, and so you were going to bump into Germans at a strong point, or at a junction of a ravine, or bump into a thing, and then you basically had to make up the drills as you went forward from the river there. So 21 Battalion is probably a reasonable example of how it all went. The companies went forward in their two columns. They encountered forward security elements at close range, but eventually they located, in one example for instance, they located a building which the Germans were holed up in. A New Zealand platoon surrounded them, called out to them to surrender. The Germans refused. The officer fired one of those signal flares and it shot through the window and set the straw alight on the inside that they'd all been sleeping on, so the Germans all rushed out. And then they discovered that, in fact, it included even the artillery officers. So essentially, as a result of the bombardment, because of the cold weather, most of the German defenders had left their posts and gone back to the more rearward position for protection, including even the forward observers of the artillery. So you know, each kind of terrain, as von Clausewitz says, has its impact on the military, but this kind of broken terrain, instead of it being generals and lieutenant colonels, this is a war for lieutenants and corporals. And many instances, and I'm not going to go through them, were individual corporals or lieutenants or whomever just taking the initiative and getting going when they're held up, they'll bypass it and keep going towards the back there. So Clausewitz's comment there is prescient, and I think in this case the new New Zealand soldiers and the new officers really proved that they could you know, they could cut it with the opposition. However, Kippenberger made the comment that it was actually generally, it was a satisfactory operation and a surprisingly easy affair. And what he was referring to there was the fact that, fortunately, we weren't taking on those Panzer Grenadiers at the back. So we were lucky enough in the first divisional operation to be fighting against a novice kind of enemy who weren't really up to it. So thankfully, it wasn't the parachutists or the Panzer Grenadiers in the security zone there. And there you just see the track lines. You can see how far they penetrated. So what they've done is they've created a bridgehead. You just can't keep pushing the infantry forward. One, they'll just run out of ammunition and steam, but you're going to outpace the ability of your tanks to cross, bridges to be built, guns to be brought forward, anti-tank weapons to come forward. So they need to pause, and there's a period of time now where they build up their combat power before they start heading inland. And going inland, I'm going to jump past Castle Frentano and San Usania and focus more on the attacks into the Orsona area that are shown there. That's what Orsona looks like today. Beautiful hilltop town. Ideal back in the day for defence. That's what it looked like in 1943-44. So you can see it, albeit that's from 1944, the snowy one on the left. You can see how it dominates the ground down below, how steep those sides of the valleys are, and why it was necessary for tanks to follow these torturous tracks up, and how difficult it was for the infantry for the objectives there. And by day, just how much observation the Germans would have. So you move around by day, you get sniper, artillery fire, mortar fire, heavy machine guns. So, you know, night operations were kind of eventually reinvented. You can see the destruction caused by artillery fire and bombing of Orsona, and that kind of rubble stops the movement of armoured vehicles and provides great hidey holes for the Germans. So quite the fortress town. What I'm going to try and do now is just flip for a couple of minutes to this bit of a promo video. Oh, okay, I might have to do the voiceover.
That's you can hear it in the background, sure.
Hang on, what's this? Sheer number of vehicles.
Ahead of them is Hellfire Corner, the start of the Mad Mile, a mile of road in full view of the German guns in Orsona. The shelling is continuous, and so is the traffic.
Food by day, you're going to get machine guns, Hellfire. So the gunners, hundreds, thousands of rounds of ammunition. It always will be taken forward, trucks and truckloads.
Shelley does not have it all his own way. From the observation post, the artillery officer keeps their lines well taken. For any sign of movement over there, he has an answer. Reading is taken, and the boys let Jerry have it. The shelling keeps the Germans below ground. To blast them out of the town, the planes are called up.
Airplanes are good, but as the weather gets worse, you can't use them, you know, cloud-based comes down, but at least the Germans can't either, but still.
Orsona is no exception. It commands the surrounding countryside. From it, the Germans can see every Allied move. Every building is a fortress. It cannot be stormed. Only bombs can drive the Germans out.
Not quite true. The bombs can't drive the Germans out, as we're going to find out, but probably a good sound bite for the folks back home.
Montgomery has just taken leave of the 8th Army. After 18 months, he has read his last order of the day as its commander. In his final speech, Monty said that he'd always tried to remember that an army was made up of human beings. He thought that the 8th Army's success was due to its emphasis on the human factor. Certainly, few modern generals have been so idolized by their men. Few have so richly deserved it. In the front lines, the Kiwis had a muddy Christmas. Christmas dinner had to be eaten out in the open. If the men had been dreaming of a white Christmas, they were disappointed. But they certainly got a white New Year.
I just wanted to get you to this point to see when we talk about being in the winter lines, not just cold, we're talking about deep snow, vehicles buried, possible, you know, for mobility, and essentially a bit like the fighting season, you know, in certain parts of, you know, say, Afghanistan and the like, during the winter, a lot of the big fighting has to split, and you focus on surviving.
That's why they're training in my area.
Yeah, that's right. I think we'll leave it there, but essentially, you get a bit of a flavour for the terrain, and just that little bit at the end, you see the impact of the weather. It was going to stop aircraft flying at both sides, but it means you can't rely on aircraft to do the bombing or the strafing because, you know, the cloud or the rain or the visibility might prevent it. So the first attack on Orsona takes place. It's just a single battalion, and so they apply a little bit of force there and sneak in using stealth and surprise. You know, this is what they've meant to do in North Africa, and they actually get into the town. But unfortunately, the New Zealand tanks get there a bit too late to support them, and the Germans put in a reasonable kind of counterattack quite quickly. So 23 Battalion, on its own, gets right into Orsona, but then gets driven out. And so the learning out of that is, well, I think we might need to do our attacks on a larger scale next time, and a lot more preparation. But it's worth at least trying to get in there with stealth and surprise, because you might just catch the Germans. And then it took a while for the Germans to react to the situation. So the next operation, just a few days later, is a full divisional operation, now in daylight. Loads of artillery and air support, although, as I just mentioned before, the weather actually impacts on the air support. And again, 24 Battalion is going to attack direct onto Orsona, supported by tanks, and 5 Brigade is going to attack up onto, try and get the high ground, running off to the east of Orsona, this Fakatiata Ridge. So 28 Maori Battalion is going to try and break that link between Orsona and Poggio Ferrito up the top, and 23 Battalion is going to have to going to try and get up on that that ridge there. So the attack sort of proceeds well enough, and again the 24 Battalion get close, this time with tanks. But what they learn this time is that the Germans quite quickly can mount effective daylight attacks, so counterattacks. So even though you've put in lots of preparation with artillery and air degraded, it's not enough to actually break through the Orsona position. And so the next day, they've survived through the night with all these counterattacks. The decision is to fall back. And, you know, this is 30 killed, 90 wounded, and about 30 or so captured. So about 150 lost just in that that brief attack there. But they've decided now, let's not attack during daylight if we don't have to. So the next one, about a week later, is Operation Florence, which is going to be a brigade-level night attack. So this time, Delta Company of the Maori Battalion is actually sent around behind Orsona to try and get beyond, in other words, to try and turn out of Orsona the defenders. If they feel they're about to be cut off, maybe they will leave the town willingly and you won't actually have to fight your way through. Meanwhile, the other two battalions of the brigade, 21 and 23, will themselves each attempt to cut that road earlier. So Delta Company of 21 does a pretty good job there getting down to the west, but again, it's not able to get all the way to its objective, but the decision is made at least to hang on there. And what we're slowly seeing is the attempt to try and cut between Orsona and the reserves at Poggio Ferrito. From the 21 Battalion perspective, it's quite a hairy night, lots of counterattacks coming in. What they find is if you take an objective or get close, you get an immediate counterattack from local resources. Within a couple of hours, another bigger one will come from somewhere else, and give it a few more hours, and you'll get a much larger and combined arms attack force. So the first counterattack in on 21 Battalion was just some troops, Panzer Grenadiers, but the final attack, including flamethrowing tanks, but their final attack came in on parachutists and infantry trying to work their way into the flank of 21 Battalion and to turn them out of that ground there. They still hadn't managed to crack Orsona, and the Germans weren't of a mind to leave at all. That's kind of, you get another view of the scale of the terrain that we're talking about, how steep it is over the back and the impacts there. In this operation, 21 Battalion alone, 9 killed, 57 wounded, which is half as many again as they'd sustained. So these operations, this is the issue with only having 6 infantry battalions now. Every operation, you're taking 20, 30, 50 casualties, you can't replace them, and you don't have 9 battalions to commit 3 or 6 at a time and rotate the other ones out, so the troops are getting fairly well exhausted. And the reason the German final counterattack between the parachutists and the tank failed is that they didn't coordinate, and so the tanks went in on their own and got destroyed, and then finally the parachutists did a ground assault, and they too were killed by New Zealand mortar and machine gun fire. And then the final attempt was what they called Operation Ulysses, and this one was a real attempt to try and turn the Germans out by getting right behind Orsona, and again you'll see 28 Battalion is at the forefront. So this is a night attack on Christmas Eve, and it's basically 5 brigade, the 3 battalions, 21, 23 and 28, reinforced by a 4th battalion from the 6th brigade, number 26 battalion. And what they want is for the 3 battalions to seize that same ridgeline up the top there, with 28 battalion's objective being to the north of Orsona itself. They had 272 artillery pieces firing in support on a 3.5 kilometre frontage, so that's about one gun for every 12 to 13 metres. So that's how much. So now that deciding to do this thing at night, but let's use heaps of firepower as well. The tanks being tasked to protect the infantry by accompanying them and to exploit, if possible, in other words, if they can, to push on beyond the objectives. That doesn't become possible. So HR is 0400 hours. So it's what we would call a noisy night attack. That is to say that instead of trying to approach the objectives quietly in the night, unobserved, without preparatory bombing by aircraft or artillery barrages, unlike, say, the Sanger or the other ones, this time they're going to fight us anyway, so let's blast the hell out of them, and hopefully, while they're crouching in their bunkers in all days, we'll be able to close up and actually get in and onto our objective. 28 Battalion, you see it attacking there. Just to give you an idea of the numbers and the impact of previous operations, it's already down to 630 out of the 800 men that it should have. So the companies are very small. They do seize the high ground to the north of Orsona. Their depth company under Captain Matahiri is now required to mop up. So in the night, as you advance, you usually bypass some Germans who may be hiding away, trying not to get themselves killed, or you've just missed them in the dark, and so you get beyond them and they start firing. So the older company was in there doing the bobbing up behind the forward elements. And then a squadron of 20 Armoured Regiment arrives, and then it starts to help 28th Battalion consolidate the position. And then the tanks are able to, you can see, using 28th Battalion as the shoulder to guard them, the tanks have been able to come out all the way around the back and go up and support 26th and 21st Battalion. So they just can't move across country like they're able to do in North Africa. You had to wait until roads were cleared and until you were protected by the infantry so that you could move. And then with the coming of daylight and the bad weather, there were limited options for the tanks or 22 Battalion to then go into pursuit mode. And again, 22 killed, 97 wounded. So, you know, that's a lot of casualties to be taken for really not much gain. They've pretty much tried everything now. Blasting them, silent attacks, large-scale attacks, small attacks. So the Germans, it wasn't through lack of fighting spirit or anything. It was just basically the Germans had really strong defended positions, and using their protected mobility with their half-tracks and their tanks, they would quickly move and then sort out any penetrations with counterattacks. So pretty much the operations in the Sandra or Sonia region start to grind to a halt here. As you saw in the little video, there was no snow on the ground on Christmas Day, but then it started to heave down. And the war became, for the next few weeks, one of patrolling, observation posts, ambushes, and sharp encounters. It was unpleasant and miserable for both sides, cold, wet, or snow, slush. Any movement by day in the open ground, you get shot at by sniper, machine gun, artillery, mortar, all that sort of thing. And many of the New Zealand positions were on forward slopes, and they were therefore by day under direct observation of the Germans, and so the men would actually have to hide in the slip trenches during the day, could only be relieved to come out at night. Resupply was by night and often by mule at that. And they were able to get some rotation of the frontline units, even within companies or within battalions or between battalions. The Germans were quite active in the patrolling until, and again I'm talking about our lieutenant's war here, 12 Platoon B Company, 28th Battalion, 2nd Lieutenant Tukarua. Right, he spots a German patrol, silently gets his men together, and they ambush this patrol and cause sufficient casualties that essentially, in the New Zealand sector, German patrolling ceases. And that's how, if you, by patrolling, can dominate the opposition's patrols, then they are less likely to mount them, which means they get less information and you get less casualties. And essentially, you can see Route 5, as I've shown it up there, that was what the intent line was, but the winter line, as it's now become, because they have stopped there basically for the winter and all dug themselves in, or if you can't dig in, you're usually hiding in a casa, in an Italian stone house, or you've made some sort of shelter trying to get away from the wind, the rain, and the snow. And then on the 17th of January, the New Zealand Division is relieved and sent across to the west side of the Apennines, where it's going to join the Americans to support operations against Casino. And probably the reason for this is that because the New Zealand Division has those tanks, as well as the infantry, they probably want to use it as a breakout force. So ideally the Americans think they're going to break in to Casino, and then the New Zealanders will break out towards Rome. But actually the way it happened, I'm not going to talk about next year's talk when that comes in, but essentially New Zealanders end up having to do a break in and then probably a breakout as well. So it's and they're not best equipped for that, given all the tanks that they've got. So was it really the soft underbelly? I don't really think so. you know, that casualty count is pretty high. And, you know, Field Marshal Kesselring, you know, came up with a damn good plan. I don't think there was anything that the New Zealanders, you know, they were learning as they went. They were certainly up for the fighting, but the terrain, the German positions, the weather, a whole lot of conditions meant that it was extremely difficult fighting. And, you know, this is why it doesn't actually end until 1945. But that casualty count, 1,500, that's at least two, almost three infantry battalions worth of casualties taken. And most of those casualties are going to be taken by the infantry or the tank crews. So a lot of your combat forces are being chewed up. And this is only the first 3 or 4 months of a campaign that's, you know, the better part of 18 months. So there were lots of lessons learned. And one of the things that I found incredible, I didn't know this until I did the reading by Phillips, who was our official historian on the Italian campaign, was that probably 80 to 85% of the division wasn't actually even fighting, or not, certainly not on the front line. So you got a very small group of infantry actually engaged in combat, but you need all the rest. If you don't get those truck drivers bringing up that fuel and those the ammunition for the artillery, you've just not got any artillery firing. And even the tanks, you know, require a lot of maintenance ongoing and through a campaign, and so you need all those vehicle loads. So they learned a lot of lessons. They certainly learned the benefit of patrolling, and if you can dominate the opposition's patrols and learn about the reaction and the layout of the defences, so they were relearning all the stuff that they didn't actually have to do or couldn't do in North Africa because of the extreme distances. They relearned the idea of a preference for night operations, but generally not silent. They were normally going to be noisy night operations, in that fire support would precede the attack and thereby give the game away that an attack was coming, because it was felt better to do that than to be sprung and no preparation, and certainly better than to be doing attacks in daylight unless you really, really, really had to. They learned about the necessity for bringing the tanks forward to be available for when the Germans inevitably counterattacked. But they also learned that you had to carefully manage the limited routes to prioritise tanks, artillery, ammunition, movement of troops, because the roads and the bridges, as you see in that photo there, only have a certain amount of capacity. So was the division structure really up to it? I think it was great that they had the tanks, because I don't know that they would have enjoyed the same support that they did get out of British lines, but they really did hurt for the lack of those additional 3 infantry battalions. And they therefore were probably more suited to the kind of operations and terrain that they probably anticipated going to in northwest Europe, but instead, as a result of decisions taken at that Casablanca conference, they found themselves in Italy, where the tanks were useful, but they weren't probably the best asset to have had at the time. Just, I skipped over a quote by Jennifer Mallinson, but anyway, that's essentially that's some of the reference I consulted. But having got to within 5 minutes of the nominated end time, I'm happy to take a few questions and comments. And I do mean comments. I mean, some of you yourselves may have travelled to Italy or visited some of the sites or have relatives or others who are involved and want to just say a bit there. But that concludes it from my point of view, but I'm more than happy to take questions and have any.
Questions? Comments?
Yeah, just in terms of the casualty rate that you were saying, and bearing in mind that they headed straight across to a Casino, how often were reinforcements?
Well, they were fairly regularly. They come in, they move the Māori base camp, came up towards that place in Taranto, and instead of, you know, the the Auckland battalions, the Wellington battalions, the Maori battalion, the South Island battalions having different efforts. They clued them all together. And instead of saying, oh, well, you guys are all Aucklanders, you can only go to 21 or 24, apart probably from the Maori battalion, everyone else just got slammed straight into the combat units as quickly as they could get them and then bring them across to make up. They got pretty slick at it, but you had to get them in. There was still the occasional hold up through shipping and all the rest of it, but they never got to the point of North Africa where just prior to LLMA they really hadn't received reinforcements for months simply because of the lack of shipping. Yeah, it was a pretty slick system that they got to, and actually it's the same model we still try and use for deployments,
right.
Getting people into theatre, get them all set up, and then you take them forward from there.
Any other questions?
So did they have time to settle in with the established troops before going into combat then?
Well, yes, they spent, and it was only really a couple of weeks, but they did training out of that Bowery base camp, up at Taranto base camp, based around likely operations and material. So Montgomery, as had he'd shown in North Africa, and indeed Freiburg, Kippenberger, as commanders, they understood the value of training realistically for likely operations, and so they insisted on training for the sort of, but you actually, until you've done it, you know, you don't really know, but yes, they did. They tried to train for the operations that we anticipated.
Yeah.
There's a lot of training done in New Zealand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is a good
When they re-rolled Full Brigade to become an armoured brigade, my father was actually part of 20 Battalion, and they spent nearly 7 months in Wairu, training with tanks before they were, they shipped over there. So the training in New Zealand was quite intensive, and then they went into North Africa for those that came through at that stage the end of 1942, early 1943, and then they spent more time in Egypt before they then got shipped through to Taranto, to Bari, and they spent more time training there. So in fact, those reinforcements, or those later embarkations, actually were quite reasonably well trained in their role as infantry and armour until they actually got into the countryside.
I'm thinking more of them actually getting to know the troops that they would be fighting with when they were...
it wasn't as bad as American reinforcements, say, in the Northwest, where you didn't even ask a name, apparently, because they were probably going to be dead. I never got involved in it. I don't think the New Zealanders are like that. There was definitely a difference between the new ones and the old hands and the way they reacted, but there was very much the idea of coaching, mentoring, and then looking after the new ones to get them properly prepared mentally and all the rest of it to do stuff. So,
would you agree that in the first few weeks anyway, it was an entirely different war from North Africa?
Yeah, totally. People were around, villagers. You know, you go into a town, they saw bombed villages which they hadn't seen before. Locals were still around there. There were homes you could go in and there was wine. I mean, there were even options to abscond, and some didn't occasionally. But, you know, it was a completely different type of warfare. Instead of the minefields, you had the rivers separating the tanks and the infantry. That was the same, but the terrain, the formations, the style of fighting was all different. Added to that, radio had arrived, a wireless, and so instead of it only getting down as far as the battalion commander, now it was down to company and sometimes down to platoon level, and so you understood way more about what was going on. The CO could call for artillery fire, but also at the same time, instead of those junior ranks cracking on and doing stuff, often they'd ask permission. Or worse, the CO would ask, what's going on? Why? You know, and so you had all this sort of stuff going on, but it was different. It was quite different to North Africa. But I think the experience of combat and leadership and looking after your troops and all of that, that carried itself through. That was the bit that was the same.
that doesn't change.
No, it doesn't change.
Not as far as New Zealand forces has never changed, really. Any other questions? No? It's getting on, nearly dinner time. Peter, thanks very much for that. If you want to have a good read, this particular book that Peter was referring to by Jenny Mallinson, from Taranto to Trieste, she's actually a New Zealander, but she's lived in Italy probably for the last 30-odd years, speaks Italian, you know, superbly. And what she did do was to track the New Zealand division from the time that they arrived in October right the way through to the end of the war. And there's sort of before and after shots of all the photographs out of the official photography and official histories, together with the photos that she took while she was actually visiting all of the places and reading it. And what I did actually was to put this on one table, had the official history of 20 infantry battalion and armoured regiment, and I had my dad's war diaries from 1943, 44, 45, and actually followed them all before we went to Italy and then followed it on the ground. And I tell you what, this is an absolute superb book, so I would certainly recommend it to anybody. I'll put you on the list. Okay, so can I ask you all to join with me in thanking you.